In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
The big vulnerability for mosquitoes as vectors is, I'm going to hold my arm up to the microphone, is that, try to
right.
Record a slap noise.
Ah, yes. Weekends at the cottage, or camping, or out in the park, or basically anywhere in Canada in the summertime, other than inside or surrounded by hot, dry concrete. Right now, if handled properly, mosquitoes in Canada are an annoyance, a buzzkill, even. Yes, they are capable of spreading West Nile virus, but it's not terribly likely, at least not right now. But if the role of this little critter throughout the entire scope of human history tells us anything, it is not likely to stay that way. A new book on the history of the mosquito reports that the best estimates are that about 108 billion humans have ever lived on this planet, and 52 billion of them died due to mosquito-borne diseases. And no, those diseases are not present in the suckers that are ruining your evening outside this weekend. They are not as far away as they used to be, either. And if there's one thing we should know about mosquitoes by now, it's that they will survive, and they will spread, and they will find a way to make our lives miserable. So it's probably only a matter of time. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Bug Story. Dr. David Fisman is an epidemiologist at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. He has seen his fair share of mosquito-borne diseases. Hi, David. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
When people like me ask you questions about mosquitoes, what is the most common thing we get wrong, the common assumption?
Most of the people who ask me about mosquitoes are my family members.
Really?
And they usually just want to know, oh, is it okay to put DEET on small children? Which I think is still risk-benefit kind of stuff. So in terms of my professional opinion, as an epidemiologist who does infectious diseases, people seldom seek out my opinion. And I sort of tend to foist it on them. I think the most important thing about mosquitoes is that, you know, as you've said, they've had this tremendous impact on human history, human civilization. I mean, the whole way the Vatican's laid out, with the Pope having a summer residence up on a hillside outside Rome, that's all about malaria. I mean, you know,
really,
the word malaria is an Italian word, just like influenza. It's, you know, the air is bad. Got to get the Pope out of Rome so he doesn't die of malaria. So these diseases have really shaped, you know, civilization, how we've been governed, how the globe was colonized by Europeans, right? And I think, to me, as someone who does infectious disease stuff for a living, the most common misconception is that it's about the mosquitoes being there or not being there. Because mosquitoes are kind of everywhere. You know, you can go to northern Canada, obviously, and the mosquitoes aren't around in the winter, and the winter is long, but come that thaw, the mosquitoes are back. So there are many, many genera of mosquitoes. Within each of those, there are many species. Some can spread disease, some can't. But the spread of disease doesn't tend to be about there being a particular mosquito somewhere or not. I think that's the misconception. I agree with your premise, or your question is, should we be concerned about global environmental change that we think is driven by largely by humans? All of those things, you know, abundance of water, drought, temperature, all of those things have to do with mosquito abundance, mosquito biting rates, and, you know, where mosquitoes are going to find habitat. And that's extremely important in terms of how infectious diseases move.
When I say, and when I hear from friends and relatives that when they're up at their cottage this year and last year, it seems like the mosquitoes last longer into the year, are in more abundance, and are just way, way worse than they've ever been. Nobody's exaggerating. Are we right?
In terms of the absolute abundance, I can't comment on that. I know so far this year we don't have West Nile, but it's not August yet.
Is that the peak period?
Yeah. So the two mechanisms for human disease that comes from mosquitoes is, broadly speaking, two mechanisms. One is you can have what's called an amplification cycle that involves humans and mosquitoes. An example of that would be something like malaria, where, you know, someone, a mosquito actually may come off an airplane from an area with a lot of malaria in New Jersey, let's say, which doesn't have endemic malaria anymore. And someone opens that suitcase and the mosquito has malaria, it bites that person. Now, if you're in an environment where there are some number of other mosquitoes that can spread that disease, they may also bite that person and they then become infected. If they then go off and feed on other people, get blood meals from other people, they infect them. And that's what's called an amplification cycle. So let's say the mosquitoes from that one person are sufficient to infect five other people via intermediate mosquitoes. That's what we would call a reproduction number of five. So you need to have the right mosquitoes there, the right types of mosquitoes. And you also have to have mosquitoes, the right types of mosquitoes that are biting enough to get those five other people infected. But they'll then be fed on by mosquitoes. And if each of them produces another five cases of malaria, now you've gone from one case to five cases to 25 cases. And that's what's called an epidemic. It's an exponential growth process that perpetuates itself. And epidemics are really scary.
How fast can that happen?
Oh, very fast. Do you remember the Ebola outbreak in 2015 in West Africa that had everybody kind of freaked out? I mean, that was over a period of a couple of months.
Right.
That you went from, you know, basically a handful of cases to, I think by the end of it, there was some 30,000 cases. Because you're dealing with exponential growth. How fast it happens depends on what people talk about as the generation time, which is the interval between a case being infected and their basically offspring cases being infected. So the shorter that is, the faster it happens. With things like West Nile, or there's a disease called Ross River virus that they have in Australia, for example, what you have there is you have a human animal amplification cycle and we're collateral damage. So, for example, with West Nile, the reason the mosquito pools start turning positive usually late July or August, and maybe later this year because we had the cool spring, is that it goes mosquito, bird, mosquito, bird, mosquito, bird. And you have that same amplification cycle that results in increasing disease prevalence in the birds, which makes the mosquitoes more and more likely to get infected. And somewhere through that summer, when you have a high enough prevalence of infection in mosquitoes, you reach a point where mosquitoes that will feed both on birds and humans, which are a minority of mosquitoes, they start to be infected too. And then those are called bridge vectors. So they'll bridge those two populations. So you get the disease moving from an animal population to us. And we're dead-end hosts. So we can get sick with West Nile, but we're not going to, you know, give it to a mosquito and give it back to a bird. So we're a dead end.
How efficient are mosquitoes compared to other creatures at spreading these kind of diseases?
The big vulnerability for mosquitoes as vectors is, I'm going to hold my arm up to the microphone, is that, try to record a slap noise. They don't live long, right? Yeah. Their lives are, I can't remember who said it, nasty, brutish, and short, right? And so you have that built into the math when people look at how do these epidemics grow. One of the most important factors is that mosquitoes that get infected are very likely to die soon. They're very likely to die before they feed on someone again. And that keeps this reproduction number down. It turns out that what's most important in driving diseases that, well, it would be in driving all of these diseases, because whether it's a mosquito to animal to mosquito disease or mosquito to human to mosquito disease, what's going to drive that is the biting rate. Because the biting rate both impacts the rate at which mosquitoes infect and the rate at which mosquitoes are infected. So there's a math expression for this reproduction number, which is the number of new cases you get from an old case in a totally susceptible population. And some of the things that are in there are mosquito density. How many mosquitoes are there per human, per creature? How long do the mosquitoes live is in that expression. The biting rate is the one squared term in that expression. So the more mosquitoes bite, the more they get infected, but also the more they infect us, or the more, in the case of West Nile, they infect birds. So to bring this all back to climate change, guess what mosquito behavior turns out to be really temperature sensitive?
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
That's not good.
That's not good, is it?
So what happens exactly?
So here's an argument that I've made. This isn't published. I've suggested this in lectures, okay? I think this is probably probably true. You know, I think in Canada, we think about the U.S. and the slave trade. Brazil was really the great slaving nation in the Western Hemisphere for a very long time. It was the epicenter of the slave trade. And there, you know, just millions and millions and millions of human beings and mosquitoes were trafficked from sub-Saharan Africa to South America, mm-hmm. and people died a lot, and a lot of them died of disease, right? And there's this really interesting genetic work that's gone on a disease called yellow fever, which is present in South America, but which is thought to have originated in Africa. And what you see is that disease, if you look at the lineage of the viruses, that disease was clearly introduced into South America by the slave trade. And it's spread by what are called Aedes mosquitoes, which are the baddies for a lot of this stuff. Aedes mosquitoes seem to be really good at spreading a lot of different viruses. Anopheles mosquitoes tend to spread malaria. Aedes tend to spread most of the viral diseases we worry about. Okay, so you've got this disease imported in the late 1500s from Brazil with this massive traffic of human beings. And it becomes established, it becomes, probably they must have had epidemics, and that becomes endemic. Exactly the same parts of the world have chikungunya virus and Zika virus. But we've never had chikungunya or Zika established in South America until like 10 years ago, right? And all of a sudden, these are endemic diseases in South America, notwithstanding the fact that there has been massive amounts of movement of humans, goods, and presumably insects,
right,
between those spheres over a period of about 500 years. So how is it that you never had these diseases move, yeah, and then all of a sudden they did?
Right.
If you look at the reproduction number for yellow fever, it's just higher at baseline in Aedes mosquitoes than it is in these other diseases. But the most important part of that reproduction number is biting rate, which, as I say, is temperature sensitive. The other thing that's temperature sensitive is how fast the virus develops and becomes infectious in the mosquito before it bites again. So you have these two really important things that are temperature sensitive. With reproduction numbers, it's like a tipping point thing, right? If the reproduction number is below one, you know, I show up, sort of thing I might do, show up at a party and I'm ill with some unusual infectious disease, Mr. Fun, and I infect on average 0.9 or 0.8 new cases, right? I can't infect part of a human, but if the average ratio of an old case to a new case is less than one, what happens is you can get a chain of transmission and you can freak people the hell out with something like bird flu that is very likely to kill people it infects. But it's going to be self-limited.
Mm, right.
Once you have a reproduction number that is greater than one, even a little bit, like Ebola was probably 1.3 or 1.5, once you're into the realm of exponential growth, which you will have if your reproduction number is greater than one, things can explode. And my personal read of what's been happening in the world over the last, you know, decade or two is that you have diseases that were near that threshold, like Zika, like chikungunya, where you've always had lots of movement of people and lots of goods and, you know, and creatures between these different places. But if you push on this parameter like biting rate and also on time to become transmissible, you push on that a little bit by increasing nighttime temperatures, which they've had in Brazil. I mean, we think of Brazil as a hot place, but there are actually data. Brazil's warming too, and it's warming at night.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be really important. And if you can push that above that threshold, then you go from something that when it's introduced, which it must have been introduced over the last 500 years, it just flames out, to something that can set up epidemics. You know, it's a whole new ball game. And I think that's just such a great kind of exemplar of what climate change can do, because you don't know you've crossed these thresholds till you cross them, and we don't really know what other thresholds there are to cross that, you know, as things get warmer and warmer we may cross. You sort of recognize crossing the thresholds post hoc, which is part of why this is such a problem.
Well, what would that look like, given our current mosquito population and the diseases that they carry in Canada? You mentioned we have a better kind of mosquitoes, yeah, as these things go. But are they still susceptible to the same vectors you just described?
Well, we don't have Aedes mosquitoes, which seem to be the real bad actors in Canada. The climate change projections, they do in Texas and they do in Florida. The concern that people have mostly articulated around climate change and mosquito-borne disease in North America has related to a disease called dengue, which is pretty common in the Caribbean. One of the colloquial names for it is breakbone fever. I've never had it, but the climate change projections suggest, oh, well, that may move north. you know, about as far north as Chicago. I mean, that's getting kind of close-ish to us.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say, oh, well, it's Chicago. It'll be fine, you know? And maybe it will be. But my cautionary tale about projections is they tend to be conservative. And you, again, only realize they're wrong post hoc.
My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.
Do people in Canada understand the threat that mosquitoes can pose in other parts of the world? Well, because, I mean, they're, to so many of us, they're an annoyance at the cottage here.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that I think in generally, no. Most people probably find out about that threat if they're doing adventure travel or something like that. You know, there's a, I don't do travel medicine anymore, but there's an old joke in the travel medicine community that you see the two kinds of patients. The one is the patient who comes to travel medicine clinic and follows all your recommendations, and they're on their way to a Club Med where they're, you know, the yeah. risk to them is approximately zero. And the other person who doesn't come to the travel medicine clinic is planning to go to the Amazon with, you know, a knife in their boot and all their rations in their backpack, and you see them after they come back.
Right.
Right? So, no, I don't think people are broadly aware of the terrible – I mean, you're talking about 5 million deaths a year worldwide from malaria alone. It's staggering. And I think that's a great point, because that's another reason why this is relevant to us in Canada, is we travel a lot. And what you have with climate change, there's a beautiful article from a couple of years ago by a group at University of Michigan where they had access to data from Ethiopia and Colombia, where people have tended to build – you know, their towns on mountainsides because they're high up, and the cooler it is, the less malaria there is. And what you have with warming is it's getting warmer at higher and higher and higher altitudes.
Right.
So they actually looked at they had household addresses for cases, and the average case household address is going up and up and up to higher and higher altitudes in these mountainous countries, and that's probably a climate change thing. And in as much as Canadians travel to places and enjoy these places, and now, you know, malaria prophylaxis recommendations can be a moving target. It doesn't always work. There's resistance. People don't always take the pills. You know, we then get to see returned travelers with fever. So even the stuff that's outside of Canada is an issue to us in Canada in terms of health resources.
So what kind of conditions do mosquitoes in Canada need to thrive, and how are those conditions changing?
Mosquitoes are funny. I'm not an entomologist.
Right.
But none of this stuff seems to be linear to my understanding. So different mosquito species will like different habitats. Some mosquito species like to lay eggs in streams. Some need still water. They do need water, but it differs depending on the different mosquito species. What that translates into epidemiologically is all kinds of different extreme weather can be bad in terms of mosquitoes. Now, not cold weather as we've had this year. That's a good thing.
But, right. But we talked about heat waves yesterday on this podcast and how it doesn't cool down at night.
Right, right. So that's an example. That's going to drive biting rates. That drives larval development times for mosquitoes. So every time mosquitoes lay eggs, the baby mosquitoes are up and flying around faster at higher temperatures.
Right.
If you think about droughts, a drought may mop up a lot of the water, but you may have a phenomenon, for example, where in a creek that was previously fast flowing and that was good habitat for one kind of mosquito, now you just have stagnant pools that are good habitat for another kind of mosquito. I had a friend when I was in grad school who had been a malaria control officer in Ethiopia, and they had had a civil war. The Ethiopia-Eritrea war was going on at that point. And, you know, this guy's nightmare were shell holes because, something blows up and leaves a hole in the ground, then it rains, and then it's full of water. And that, you know, that to him was this great threat that, you know, that's
right.
where malaria is going to come from. So the water stuff is probably generally not good. Droughts probably sound like they'd be good, but are not necessarily good. Extreme weather events, definitely not good, because now you have puddles everywhere and flooding and so forth.
And that's, you know, controlling stagnant water lying around is one of the old standbys for malaria control.
I remember that from when West Nile first
showed up. From West Nile too, yeah. The plastic flower pots with the standing water, yeah.
So as climate becomes warmer, mosquito season becomes longer, and the bite rates, which you say increase with temperature, continue to climb, what are some of the things that we need to do either from the government level or even from, you know, a personal landscaping level to try to control this?
You know, in terms of what you can control as an individual, any public health agency, you can go on the website and they'll say, oh, you know, wear long pants and tuck your pants into your socks
right.
and so forth in terms of the tick stuff and use DEET. And sure, I mean, that's all great and folks can do that. You know, to some extent, these patterns and these changes are bigger than something that any individual can really deal with. So I think it's important to be educated in terms of government and probably, you know, this is my creeping public health agenda. Get it into your podcast. To me, and I mean, obviously this sounds self-serving because I'm an epidemiologist and what we do is we study disease in populations. But I really feel strongly, and I think Lyme disease is a good example of this, is you can't come up with good control policy if you are flying blind and you have no idea what's going on. So a lot of knowing what's going on relates to actually investing in public health infrastructure so you can do surveillance and surveilling for not just the things you know are already here, mm-hmm. but in the context of climate change, surveilling for things that aren't here but could be here. So the Lyme disease is a great example of why it's really dumb to say this is not here, we don't need to worry about it. And then suddenly it's here and it looks like it's growing explosively for the first few years, but that's just because you're counting it. So I think investing in surveillance, public health surveillance systems is really important. Beyond that, once we know what's going on, to take a page out of the West Nile book, I mean, if you know that mosquitoes are the issue, you can do, larva control in catch basins and things like that. You know, there are larvicides you can use. If it gets bad enough, you can actually use insecticides. No one likes that because obviously you're spraying toxic agents mm-hmm. into people's environments. So the bar to do that's pretty high. But none of that's on the table if you don't even know what's going on.
Last question. As someone who studies this stuff and works in the field on this stuff, when you think about mosquitoes in Canada, what is your nightmare?
Here's what I'll say, and this is a problem. This is part of the problem, is we live in a really rich country. And it's pretty clear that the brunt of anything that happens gets borne by folks with lower resources. And I'm not sort of saying that as someone, you know, standing on a barricade waving red flag. Where if you look at, there's some wonderful epidemiologic work that the CDC has done at the Texas-Mexico border. You know, there's this mega city that's just Brownsville on the Texas side and Matamoros on the Mexico side. It's one city. It's got a fence down the middle. And if you look at seroprevalence for dengue, which is a common, you know, it's probably to me the biggest worry would be, oh, dengue comes north in terms of mosquito stuff. I would very much not like us to have to deal with dengue in Canada. So just to give you a straight answer.
Right.
But in terms of, you look at Texas and you look at Mexico, folks on the Mexico side of the border have much higher levels of antibody against dengue virus, which means they've historically been infected much more. And if you dig down and look at what's different about those two societies, in Texas, people have air conditioning. In Mexico, they're opening their windows to stay cool.
Right.
In Texas, they have piped water. In Mexico, they're collecting water tanks on the roof. So I think in Canada, we're really, really lucky. I don't wish dengue or West Nile or Eastern equine encephalitis or, you know, whatever else we have to deal with, I don't wish it on anybody. But to a certain extent, we're lucky that we're a rich country and we have the resources to sort of mitigate these things as they emerge. My big worry about climate and infectious disease, and I'm not trying to dodge your question, but this is my big worry, extends way beyond mosquito-borne disease and in fact relates largely to displacement and movement of large numbers of people. So I think, which I know doesn't sound like it's infectious disease related, but if you look at some of the great infectious disease catastrophes in history, a lot of those have to do with war, with displacement, with movement of people. 1918 flu is an example. You know, people think it probably had something to do with massive movements of large numbers of soldiers. You look at the refugee crisis
in Syria and the havoc that that's created worldwide, you know, the political havoc, some of the other issues that have come out of a refugee crisis generated by a catastrophe in a relatively small country. And now let's start thinking about massive water shortages in India. Let's start thinking about massive desertification in Africa. Let's start thinking about massive loss of, you know, Pacific Islands. And where are those people going to go? So to me, as an infectious disease epidemiologist, the scariest thing is not, oh, ticks are moving north or mosquitoes are moving north or we have a bit more vibriosis than we used to have. And all those things are true. To me, the biggest worries are kind of third-order effects. You know, you have climate change, you have displacement of people, and then infectious disease loves misery and loves crowding of people and loves social disruption. I think you see that in places like Venezuela with resurgence of diseases they'd vaccinated away. So that, to me, is the really scary part of climate change.
On that cheery note.
On that cheery note.
Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Dr. David Fisman, epidemiologist at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. That was The Big Story, week two of our Cottage Friday Spectacular. You can find last week's by scrolling back at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also talk to us on Twitter at thebigstoryfpn. And you can find all our episodes, or at least the last 100 or so, wherever you get your podcasts, on Apple, on Google, on Stitcher, on Spotify. And we want to know what you think of us. Claire Brassard is the lead producer of The Big Story. Ryan Clark and Stephanie Phillips are our associate producers. And Elisa Nielsen is our digital editor. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Don't get bit. And we'll talk Monday.
Sound like a sick cat. Yeah, I was going to say. I can't do it.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.